Test 1, 2, 3.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday here at Radio or Not. I am Nicole Sandler. Thanks for joining in the discussion, the back and forth, although it's tough to do the back and forth thing when I'm still sort of getting the phone system figured out. But we will get there. Yes, you know, I had a little bit of a setback by being gone for a week. But I am back, and we have a good show for you tonight. I'm waiting for our first guest to call in because we've got a busy first half hour this evening. In just a moment, we're going to hear from a guy that I've never spoken with before on the air anyway. His name is Miles Mogilescu, and he's an entertainment attorney who has a piece on Huffington Post today called The Real Reason Obama's Plan Doesn't Include a Public Option. And, you know, we learn something new, it seems, every day or almost every day about our president. And unfortunately, what we're learning is pretty disappointing stuff. You know, we all knew about the deal that Obama cut with Big Pharma. Now, and I'm going to paraphrase, because it's easier that way. Basically, Big Pharma makes about $85 billion a year, and Big Pharma is the name of the lobbying group that represents all the big pharmaceutical companies. All right. So the association, the joint venture, all the big pharmaceutical companies in the U.S., if you mush them all together, make about $85 billion a year in profit. Pretty obscene. Yeah. Now the deal that the White House cut with Big Pharma, was, basically had them agree to give up something in the neighborhood of $10 billion over in profits over 10 years or so. Not really a great deal for we, the American people. But what they did in return was they promised that they would run ads supporting the Democrats' plan for, you know, for this health care plan. And I guess they have been, and that's one of the reasons why, what's his name, Billy Tobin, of who was the head of Big Pharma, resigned just in the last few days, or was forced out, probably because they realized that this this deal is not good for anybody, and probably the shareholders of the big pharmaceutical companies didn't like the fact that they were getting behind this Democratic plan. All right. Well, what I learned today in this piece by Miles Mogilescu, of who wrote in Huffington Post, is there is another reason that that the Obama plan, the so-called new Obama plan, doesn't have the public option in it, and that's because apparently, according to the New York Times, which is what Miles Mogilescu cites in the story, according to the Times, there was a second deal that was cut. Yeah, I'll just read to you this little excerpt from this New York Times article from August 13th. And they're talking about a lobbying organization that represents the big for-profit hospitals. Now, if you've listened to my show for any length of time, you know my position. I think healthcare should be a not-for-profit entity. I think, you know, of course, healthcare workers, medical practitioners, doctors, nurses, physicians assistants, lab techs, you name it, have the right and should be able to earn a pretty decent living. But barring that. I don't think hospitals should be in the business of making profits, of paying off shareholders. I think they should make enough money to operate and to keep, you know, upgrading their equipment so that they are state-of-the-art facilities. But I don't think they should be turning profits. I think any money they make above their costs should go back into the hospital to keep the hospitals top notch. That's my basic premise. So according to the Times, several hospital lobbyists involved in the White House deals said it was understood as a condition of their support that the final legislation would not include a government-run health plan paying Medicare rates or controlled by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Chip Kahn, who's the director of the Federation of American Hospitals, told a Capitol Hills newsletter, we have an agreement with the White House and I'm very confident we'll be seen all the way through conference. We trust the White House. Here, therein lies the problem. Obama is making these backroom deals, and for some reason, the big pharma deal was widely reported. Now, you know, Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post is a regular guest on my show, and when that story broke about the big pharma deal, you know, the White House first admitted it, then they backed off and said, no, there was no deal. And then, you know, between Ryan Grimm and Sam Stein and the Huffington Post, they really broke the story. But what I don't get is this other deal was, included in this New York Times article from August 13th. And I will post it on my blog at radioornot.com after the show tonight when I post the podcast. The link will be there so you can read it. What I don't get is why nobody else picked up on this story. You know, I just trying to figure it out. I don't know where our guest is. So you know what? I'm going to try to call him on his cell and see if we can get him because I only have about another 7 or 8 minutes with him. And then we're going to talk to Christy Harvey of the Center for American Progress. So I want to get Miles on the phone. And we'll see if he picks up. If not, I'll just share with you some more of the highlights from his piece.
You've reached Miles, won't be less yourself.
No. All right. So hopefully he'll be calling in. I know he was going to get to a meeting early so he could call in and spend the first 15 minutes with me. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it or not, because we will hear from Christy Harvey of the Center for American Progress in a few minutes. I see the chat room is starting to fill up. Oh, and I never went into the Tom Hartman chat room either. So let me do that real quickly. I know it's, you know, this is one woman radio. All right. So while I log in there, see if Miles calls in. In the meantime, I will share again with you this, all right, the piece, and I will link to this as well from my blog tonight. The real reason Obama's plan doesn't include a public option. And what he said is the reason Robert Gibbs gives for President Obama's health care plan not including a public option, that despite majority voter support, it can't get 51 Democratic votes in the Senate, doesn't hold up. The real reason is that Obama made a backroom deal last summer with the for-profit hospital industry that there would be no meaningful public option. This is one of the great underreported stories of the health reform saga. Much has been written about the Obama administration's deal with Big Pharma to continue to block Medicare from negotiating for lower drug prices or to allow consumers to buy cheaper drugs from Canada in exchange for pharma running pro-Democratic ads and giving campaign contributions to Democratic candidates. That's the reason, under pressure from the White House, that Senate Democrats voted down an amendment that would have allowed consumers to buy cheaper drugs from overseas. You remember that. You remember that was the Byron Dorgan bill that inexplicably, if I can get the word out, saw all kinds of seemingly otherwise progressive senators vote against. And then we realized that's why, right? All right, so back to this piece. But Obama's deal with the for-profit hospital lobby to ensure there would be no public option has, as best I can tell, only been reported in two articles in the New York Times. On August 13th, the Times reported that while President Obama, and I bet this is Miles. Hi, it's Nicole Sandler with Radio or Not.
This is Miles Mogulis.
Hey, Miles. Thanks for calling. We are live on the air. I'm glad you were able to call in. I was just sharing with the listeners some of your piece that's on Huffington Post today called The Real Reason Obama's Plan Doesn't Include a Public Option. Now, by way of introduction, you're an entertainment attorney out in Los Angeles, but you're also a progressive activist.
That's my day job.
Okay. And in your spare time, you fight for progressive causes and you write for Huffington Post and other publications. And I noticed a couple of pieces you had today, one up on Huffington Post and or yesterday you posted it, and one on Daily Coast as well, talking about this deal that the White House cut with the big hot for-profit hospital lobby. And what I was just, you know, musing about was the fact that the big pharma deal was widely reported, but this one, you mentioned it had been exposed twice in the New York Times, but nobody else seemed to pick up on it. Do you have any idea why that is?
I'm not sure why that is. It's very well documented in the New York Times on two different dates. But perhaps it's because Obama has continued to talk as though he supports the public option without actually doing anything about it. So on the one hand, Obama says, I'm for public option. On the other hand, he does nothing to make it happen. And maybe for that reason, people aren't really paying attention.
Yeah, you know, he seems to sort of throw something out there that appeases us lefties, by, you know, and saying that, yes, I will support a public option if that's what the Senate brings me or whatever. Yet, as, I think you pointed out, or someone did in some of the reading I've done today, with Joe Lieberman, for instance, he was the one who held it up in the first place in the Senate bill. And he came out afterwards and said, look, I was never asked by the president to support a public option. No one has ever put any pressure on me. So the White House has not lifted a finger to move the idea of a public option forward, even though President Obama continues to say, well, he's supportive of it, but he's not going to base his entire health care plan on that.
Well, I think from the very beginning, Rahm Emanuel, and I don't think Rahm Emanuel acts without Obama's consent.
Right.
Rahm Emanuel made it very clear that a public option was not an important element of their plan, and they were very happy to trade it away. As you said, the deal with pharma has gotten a lot of publicity, but the basic approach that I think the lesson that they mislearned from the Clinton healthcare initiative back in 92 and 93 was that in order to pass a health care reform, they had to get support from all of the special interest groups that have an interest in making a profit in health care. And the first interest group they made a deal with was pharma, which reversed Obama's campaign pledge to let Medicare negotiate for lower drug prices and to let Americans buy drugs from Canada or other Western countries at lower prices in exchange for pharma promising to make contributions to Democratic candidates. And that, as you pointed out, has gotten a lot of publicity. But the other deal that was made that got less publicity is the deal with the private for-profit hospitals. And that deal was that there would be, as the New York Times reported, there would be no government-run public option in any way tied to Medicare or in any way national in scope. In other words, it would be okay if there were very weak state plans or co-ops, but any strong public option was dealt away, and the Obama administration agreed with the private health care industry that it would deal it away in exchange for they're not opposing the overall health care reform.
Right. And, you know, again, it seems like every week or so we get another inkling that this president is being less than forthcoming with us. And the fact that the New York Times reported it twice again, and I'm going to link to, both your piece at Huffington Post and these New York Times articles from my blog tonight. The more disconcerting thing than the fact that he's cutting these backroom deals is the hypocrisy. I mean, I'm used to calling the Republicans hypocrites because they talk out of both sides of their mouth all the time. But for Obama to do it and to lie to our face, I mean, the platform of the Democratic Party in the 2008 presidential election was universal health care. I mean, getting everybody covered. And though he never signaled support for single payer, Obama did come out in support of a public option, and he's done nothing but backtrack on it ever since, it seems.
Well, first of all, the public option shrank and shrank and shrank.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of a public option was supposed to be an alternative to single payer. It was supposed to be a progressive alternative that was going to be more, quote, politically pragmatic. And it was originally proposed by a Yale political scientist named Jacob Hacker,
mm-hmm.
It was going to have 125 million people in it. It was going to use Medicare pricing to keep prices down. It was the only plan that would get subsidies. Private plans wouldn't get subsidies, and therefore it would have a lot of people in it, would have a lot of bargaining power. That was then shrunk down in Congress to it would only be available to people who don't have health insurance to work. Then it was shrunk down to it couldn't use Medicare pricing. It would have to negotiate
right.
The prices.
Right, therefore, so then it was no longer a robust public option. It was just a public option. And
it
yeah.
was a puny, tiny little public option, and more, in some ways more symbolic, and something that could be built on, but nothing like what was originally talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was the puny option was passed by the House. No public option was passed by the Senate, and Obama has always backed the Senate approach.
And so now tomorrow we've got this healthcare summit, and the latest news to come out of it is the Republicans have added a name to their list of the people that they are inviting, and that's Bart Stupak. Who is a Democrat, but, he is a, I don't know, it's certainly a blue dog Democrat, but he's the Democrat who's trying to put restrictions on abortion back into this health care bill. And so he will be at this summit tomorrow as a guest of the Republican Party.
I actually hadn't seen that
yeah.
news. I've been working all day until I called into the show.
Ah, so, well, that's the latest.
That's interesting development.
Yes.
Because part of the problem the Democrats have is if they're going to go to reconciliation, they have to have something that would then be repassed by the House and repassed by the Senate. And it's not clear they have enough votes even in the House to pass this bill a second time. And if Bart Stupak, because of the anti-abortion issue, is going to oppose is going to oppose voting for it in the House and take 5 or 6 or 10 other anti-abortion Democrats with him. It's possible that even if they go the reconciliation route, it will fail.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, either way, it should be interesting television tomorrow, and I will be I'll have the recorder rolling. And
well, I'll be TiVoing it, too. Uh-huh. Probably watch it late at night.
Right, and so we'll share highlights of it tomorrow night. You will see. I hope somebody asks Obama. The thing is, it's not a press event. It's members of Congress. But I hope somebody does ask him about this. If not, I'm certainly going to talk with some reporter, blogger friends of mine and ask them to look into it. So, I really appreciate you, Miles Mogilescu, calling attention to this today. I will post to your story from my blog at radioornot.com tonight.
Well, I hope people read it and follow through on it, because I think it's, sometimes I feel like I'm telling the truth and I wish I weren't.
Yeah. Well, I get it. That's sort of how I felt when I read it. It's like, oh, why is he doing this? So, I'd rather know the truth, but I wish the truth were something different.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. Miles Mogilescu. Am I saying?
Mogilescu.
Entertainment attorney. Now, you were involved in a couple of films recently that we know about. In fact, you're an entertainment attorney, so I don't know, if you had anything to do with it, but you worked on the film Bobby, the one about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think a friend of mine did the music for that film, a guy named Paul Cantalone. But
I don't think he did the music for it.
No, maybe I've got it mixed up with another film.
Maybe another film.
Okay. All right. Well,
I earned my living as an entertainment lawyer. Occasionally, some of the films I'm involved with, I'm proud of. Some of them, I'm not so proud of. We all have to earn a living.
Most definitely. For some of us, it's easier than others. Miles Mogilescu, I really appreciate you taking the time out. I know you're on your way into a meeting, and so thank you for making time for us tonight here at Radio or Not.
Well, thank you, too. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. All right, and unfortunately, I think I missed Christy Harvey, but let's see if maybe we can get her at least on the cell. This is my problem with not having a call screener here. What did I do with Christy's number? I know how we can find it. Bear with me. Christy is, from the Center for American Progress, and she does a show at a radio show up in Alaska where she's living this day. And so she was going to call me from the studio, and so I may not be able to get her, but hey, we'll find out. We will find out. If not, that's okay, too. I've got another interview I'm going to share with you in a few minutes, but we'll see if we can get Christy right now for a few minutes anyway. One ringy dingy. By the way, I'm going to see Lily Tomlin next week. It might even be this week. I think it's Friday night. I should call and see if I can get an interview with her, huh? She's,
Hey, you've reached 3-2.
Nope, and we don't want to give her number out on the air either. All right, well, so we missed Christy Harvey, but we will, we're going to get her back on every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30. So we'll start off the show with Christy on Wednesdays coming up. You know what? Let me do this because I got to turn the air conditioning on in here because it is way, way hot. So I am going to play a quick song. Oh, maybe that's her calling now. Hi, it's Nicole, Radio or Not.
Hey, it's Christy.
Hey, Christy, I'm so sorry. I was trying to wrap up this other interview and the way my phone system works, I couldn't figure out.
That's absolutely fine. I figured I'd keep trying till 2:30 and then we could just try it again next week. I'm here if you still want to do something.
I do, and we are on live. I'm so glad you called back. So Christy Harvey is from the Center for American Progress, Director of Strategic Communications, and it was a regular on my show on Air America, and I'm so glad that you'll continue doing it. We'll move it to Wednesdays in this half hour because there's some great stuff. First of all, Center for American Progress is just a wonderful organization, and you guys operate on so many different levels. And you have a website that's part of the Center for American Progress, but it's really aimed at people like me who do radio shows. It's called miccheckradio.org, and you are going through a redesign that's going to launch its new site next week?
Next Monday, yeah. I'm really excited about it. And when the Center for American Progress was put together, going on 7 years ago, the point was to have a muscular, research-oriented think tank that also could operate like a political campaign. So that also had a rapid response capability and also the capability to reach out to TV and to radio and make sure that the progressive message really was heard. And so Mike Check itself has been around for a couple of years, but we're doing a big redesign, and it's both for radio and just for people who want to keep up on what the big fun news stories are of the day.
Right, and you do it in a way that, it's easy to read, easy to access. Sometimes part of the problem is I don't have enough hours in the day to go through everything, and you give a nice compendium of a lot of different stories, and I enjoy having you on once a week because you can sort of give me the best of the best.
Why, thank you. Yeah, part of the problem we realized is we had lots of people doing lots of smart things, and there's a lot going on in Washington, but Washington starts to speak its own language. Mm-hmm. And so basically when I started the site, everything had to pass the Trudy test, which meant if my mom, Trudy, could not understand it immediately,
uh-huh.
and she watches news and she's plugged in, but she doesn't obsessively watch C-SPAN kind of thing, if Trudy couldn't understand it, we didn't put it in. And so it taught us to rethink the news in a way that was more understandable to most people as opposed to congressional staffers or something like that.
Perfect. All right. Well, I know we only have a short time tonight because you've got your radio show coming up in about a half hour, but let's talk big deal today. The Senate passed the jobs bill today.
They did, and this is a pretty big deal. It's the so-called skinny jobs bill, the pared-down version. It was $15 billion compared to the $154 billion one that went through the House, and it actually had stronger-than-expected bipartisan support. 13 Republicans joined the Democrats and the Independents and passed it 70-28. And kind of interesting to see how that happened because there were 8 different Republicans who did not vote to end cloture, did not vote earlier this week to let this bill go forward. And once they saw that it was inevitably going to pass, they switched sides, which was kind of interesting. But it's got 4 basic parts, and all of the parts are specifically aimed, very, very laser-like aim, at creating jobs or helping businesses employ people or things like that. So, it was kind of a big deal. Good news, finally.
Well, you know, Scott Brown got the ire up of a lot of Republicans because he was one of the 5 who sided with the Democrats on the cloture vote, who didn't filibuster it. And, you know, which I think signaled progress. But now you said another 8 came out of the woodworks and crossed over the aisle, which the Republicans just have not been doing in this Congress. So maybe it's the beginning of some of them finally saying, all right, we need to start doing what's best for the country rather than just towing this very strict party line of no.
Well, and I think also it's very, very hard to go back to your district. Most of the districts are still feeling the impact of the downturn and of the recession that we had. It's very hard to go back and explain how you voted against bringing jobs to your state.
Yeah.
And so when they thought that they could defeat it and have a partisan victory with the cloture, everyone was, you know, ready to stand up against the Democrats to try and fight. But once they realized it was going to pass, they kind of jumped on the bandwagon so that they could go home and brag up the fact that they brought some jobs home.
Okay. The other, and that's great news. I mean, it's not as big as it should be, but at least it's a movement in the right direction. And,
exactly.
You know, I would have loved if the Republicans tried to kill a jobs bill. Well, they did try. But, you know, how can they go home and say, well, we voted against something that gives tax cuts, which is what they're all about, to businesses to create new jobs.
Exactly.
The other, obviously, big story again this week is health care reform. It's like a broken record, but maybe there's sort of a finish line somewhere in sight. The WellPoint stuff, they are jacking up insurance premium by double-digit percentage points.
Again. In 11 different states, they've said that they need to increase their premiums by, double digits. For example, the biggest one was in California where they said, things are just too expensive. We need to increase insurance premiums by 39% this year. And everyone went, what? No, that's crazy. And so there's a hearing about it. And they said, we have to because it's just too expensive. Healthcare expenses are too high. We need to keep up with them. So Representative Henry Waxman, who is, of course, my political crush man, I love everything that he does. He's he investigates things like a Hardy boy. He's just awesome. And so he dug into, what are some of these expenses that WellPoint has? And it was pretty telling. For example, 39 WellPoint executives make over $1 million a year in salary.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. They also, in the past couple of years, in 2007 and 2008, they spent $27 million on executive retreats at really fancy, posh resorts in places like sunny Hawaii and Arizona.
Yeah, because that's right, so important to doing good business. And actually, what I heard was some of their defense of this, of these retreats, these executive retreats, is, well, because it was for our agents, the salespeople, the ones who go out and sell our products. What? So without them, you couldn't gouge us for enough money? I mean,
well, exactly. And right there, okay, if you you know, cut out the millions of dollars in salary and the millions of dollars in vacations, you know, maybe then the premiums wouldn't have to go up 39%. Mm-hmm. So it's just, they were trying to play a little bit of a shell game here, and luckily Henry Waxman called them out on it.
Well, but we're still stuck with what I call this for-profit, government-sanctioned extortion industry. And nothing, even in this new Obama plan, that's sort of not really a new plan. It's just an outline of the tweaks that he thinks they can fix to get the health care bill through using reconciliation, still doesn't address a lot of the problems. I mean, it's a little better than the Senate plan.
Right.
But it has to take the Senate plan as its base, because that has to be the because it already passed the Senate. It's the only way they're going to get past the 60 they need for cloture to get by the filibuster. So they've got to use that as the basis for whatever legislation finally comes through. So they're going to tweak it and pass the tweaks through reconciliation and give us a final plan. Now, there's been a push this in the recent days for bringing back the public option. But, you know, Christy, I wonder if you heard of this yet. I just spoke with a guy, Miles Mogilescu, who wrote a piece on Huffington Post today, citing two mentions in two different New York Times stories about a second backroom deal at the White House cut. We all knew about the big pharma deal, but this one supposedly was a deal with the for-profit hospital lobbying group, the hospital industry, the Federation of American Hospitals, in which basically the White House assured them that there would be no government-run public option in the final deal.
Right. And, yeah, I buy that, because I read the same article on Huffington Post, and it has been a little bit confusing, especially to people who've really been watching what's been going on, why the White House has been so quick, especially in recent days, to say, oh, no, there's no support for the public option, when a lot of people are saying, uh-huh, we're supporting it. There's a lot of us out here who are. And so it's been a little confusing. And if this Huffington Post story is correct, it would make those kinds of things make a lot of sense. But, you know, I think at this point the White House is playing a game of pragmatism, because they know that to stay afloat and to recapture some of the public enthusiasm just for progressive policies in general, they need to pass something, and they need tomorrow's big bipartisan summit thing to at least look as if it's gone well. And so I think that they may have possibly thrown over the public option to get some support, just so they can have some victories in healthcare just in general.
Right. Now, but now this apparently was first reported by the Times back in August. And I'm just wondering why we heard all about the big pharma deal when I remember explicitly when Ryan Grimm sort of broke the story in Huffington Post, and the White House went back and forth on it, and then finally the news came out that, yeah, there was that deal. But this one seemed to fly under the radar.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway.
And I think that there's probably been so much back and forth in Congress and in Washington, both with lobbyists and with the White House and with lawmakers and members, that I think that there have probably been multiple sort of kind of deals made, and then probably quite a few that actually matured into full-fledged backroom deals like
right,
this one.
Right. All right. Christy Harvey is with us from the Center for American Progress. I know I need to let you go in a minute, but one last thing. So tomorrow is the big healthcare summit. The Republicans are screaming that it's a trap. They're being set up, which I totally don't get. But the latest salvo in this fight is their last-minute addition to their list of people that they've invited, Bart Stupak, is going to attend as a guest of the Republicans.
Yeah, they are scrambling right now. You know, first when this came out yesterday, first John Boehner's office came out and said, we can't do anything with this legislation. It's too short. After months of him carrying the previous legislation from the Senate around like it was a football for months,
right,
saying, oh, it's too long, he went complete Goldilocks. Then they came out and said, the president's going to have this event. We're going to crash it. Meanwhile, they'd been invited. The event
since
was put
day
together
one.
With
right.
them in mind.
Right. That's why it was put together. So it was a
exactly.
summit. Yes.
And so then that didn't really work because everyone knew that they had all been invited and this was put together for that reason. So now they're trying to bring in Mr. Stupak to sort of be the aunt at the picnic to try to really push the whole abortion issue as the deal breaker when everyone knows, you know, that's one little tiny thing in a much larger and more important bill. So they're trying to figure out ways to sow the seeds of a little bit of chaos tomorrow, because I think, frankly, that they're worried that this press conference slash meeting will go the way of the last time he addressed the Republicans, in which Obama looked presidential, in control, and ready to work, and they looked petty. And so I think that they fear that that could happen this time, and they're trying to put their spoilers at the front so they can afterwards, when it does go poorly for them, they can point back and say, see, this was a trap, we
right.
crashed, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Well, one last thing, Christy Harvey, because this is late breaking news. The House today voted to repeal the antitrust exemption for health insurers. The vote was 406-19.
Yeah, I saw that. And so I think, you know, they are getting together to try and look like they have been doing something, but I'm not sure what exactly they're trying to do with these things.
I'm not sure either. They're, you know, they look like a party without a plan. But,
exactly.
you know, that's often the case with the Democrats, too. And, in fact, in the next hour, I'm going to talk to Thomas Frank of The Wall Street Journal about just that. He's got a great piece up today. And it's called What's the Matter with Democrats? The party embraced globalization while its union allies were cut down. Thomas Frank, of course, one of the few liberal minds on the Wall Street Journal. So he'll be joining us in the next hour. Christy Harvey, it's so good to talk to you again. Go do your show. Thank you for hanging out with us tonight. We'll talk next Wednesday.
Fantastic. See you then.
Okay. Thanks so much. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. Find them at AmericanProgress.org. And, of course, her area is MicCheckRadio.org. And if you go there now, you'll sort of see the in-progress new site as it's being built. She's just awesome. So we'll pick up our regular weekly thing again coming up every Wednesday night from 6 to 6:30 Eastern, the first half hour of the show. All right. I'm Nicole Sandler. Before we move on, you know what? I want to play for you the Media Matters Minute from today because it deals with just what Christy was talking about. You know Media Matters, Media Matters for America, their website, MediaMatters.org. And so they put together, you know, some clips each day and do a radio minute. This one deals with the whole notion that this summit tomorrow is a big setup for the Republicans. I don't get it. Here's how it goes.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Ben Fischel. Our top item today, conservative media figures follow in lockstep with Rush Limbaugh, who called the president's bipartisan health care summit a trap for Republicans. Have a listen to Limbaugh's comments and the preceding echo chamber on Fox News.
Some might ask this morning now whether or not the Republicans will in fact decide to show up at this February 25th meeting. At the same time, Rush Limbaugh warning his listeners that it might be a trap.
The Republicans have got to be very, very careful here because this is nothing more than a trap.
Rush says it's a trap, but aren't most situations in politics a trap?
Yeah, Rush is right. Of course, it's a trap.
I think the only thing you can do with the Republicans is make them look bad. I am in full accord with Rush Limbaugh on this, that this is a trap that he is setting for the Republicans, so he will look presidential and open-minded, and they will look narrow.
For these stories and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
All right, so there's today's Media Matters Minute. In a few minutes, I may play, later on in the next hour. We'll see how we are on time. I may play another one of those with, you know what? Maybe I'll just do it now. All right, here's yesterday's, and I just have to play it right now while we're on on the topic of Rush Limbaugh, because he's just such a horrible piece of crap. In case you had any misgivings over maybe calling Rush Limbaugh a racist, just have a listen to this one.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Ben Fischel. Our top item today, conservative leader Rush Limbaugh further tests the limits of appropriate dialogue, recently criticizing President Obama with overt racial undertones. Listen as Limbaugh calls the president a, quote, primitive indigenous man.
Obama is a cargo cult. We can say that Obama is essentially a primitive indigenous guy who has the slightest idea where all this advanced technology actually comes from and how it actually is made, but he wants it all.
And listen as Limbaugh accuses the president of having a, quote, black dialect.
This is what Harry Reid was talking about. Obama can turn on that black dialect.
Unbelievable.
When he wants to turn it off. And the President of the United States just said here, as a condition of receiving access to Title I funds, we will axe.
Oh, he did not.
The states.
He
Who's he
did
trying to
not.
Reach out here to? The Reverend Jackson?
For these stories and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
First of all, I've heard many white people say axe. It's just, it's a sign of bad education. Oh, good boy. He just rubs me the wrong way. All right. Let me tell you what's coming up on the show tonight. It's been a busy time already, but we've got a lot more coming up. Thomas Frank, you know him. He wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? He is a wonderful columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, he's one of the only, you know, one of the only liberals working at the Wall Street Journal. So I give him a lot of kudos just for doing that. But he wrote a great piece today that's posted online. And again, I will, after the show tonight, when I put up the podcast at radioornot.com, I will put links to all these articles and things that we talked about during the show and all the people that we spoke to. But his new piece that's up today is called What's the Matter with Democrats? The party embraced globalization while its union allies were cut down, and it is a brilliant piece. You know, the Democrats' circular firing squad, he addresses it beautifully. So we'll get to that. We'll hear from somebody at the Talk Radio News Service too. But I thought we'll take a few minutes here. I was able yesterday morning, you could tell I had just flown in from California. I got a couple hours of sleep and I woke up to record this interview because he sounded so interesting. It's an author. We're going to get off politics, but we do talk politics in here, and you'll understand where it's coming from in a moment. His name is Joe Hill, and he writes horror books. In fact, hold on, because I've got the camera propped up on this book, so sorry if you're getting seasick here. This is his new book, Horns, Joe Hill. And his name may not sound familiar unless you read one of his first two books, which we'll talk about during the interview. But here's the thing that intrigued me about him, and I hate to say it, but sometimes a hook is a hook, and, you know, you talk to people for different reasons. His father is Stephen King. And now Stephen King owns a progressive talk radio station in Maine. Actually, it was a music station. He just flipped to progressive talk. And I know, Stephen King is fascinating. So yes, I did want to talk to Joe Hill. And when I got him on the line, they connected me with him. He immediately jumped in with a question for me, about Air America. So I let the whole thing run. So you'll hear even before we were doing the official interview. All right, and then I'll be back in about 20 minutes, and we'll keep going. Here we go with Joe Hill. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. So I got to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you guys still do the Steve Earle show?
Oh my God! You know, I guess nobody told you. Air America went dark last month.
I did know that, but okay. I was wondering you know, what's happening with the shows? Have some of them been picked up by other stations? And what's going on? What's the story?
No, right now, Air America, you know, fell apart. So Steve Earle, I don't think, had been doing his show for a while, although that was a great show, wasn't it?
It was a great show, and that was my impression, was that it had run for a couple of years, and then it just sort of, you know, he went on to do his other stuff, to make his albums or
yeah.
do whatever he wanted to do next.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of it. I just started watching this show, The Wire, and he's all over that. He's got a great cameo on that.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
It was in my, well, what's going on with Air America?
Well, so Air America's gone. I moved my show online. And I'm working on a few different things. You know, I do my show nightly now from 6 to 8 at radioornot.com, which is my website. And sorry, I just got back from a week in California, and I brought with me a nasty cold or something. So excuse my voice. Yeah, and I got back at 6 this morning. So I woke up for you.
So, thanks. Well, no worries about your voice. I just got over a rancid little stomach flu myself, and all I can say is I'm glad I got it when I did instead of 3 days later in the middle of this book tour.
Well, I was just reading on your blog about that. So you're feeling better now?
Yeah. I still can't eat anything except like bagels and scones, but I'm doing okay. When you post the interview to your site, it's up on the site, I'll be sure to link to it from the blog.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, yeah, it will go up because I was gone all last week and I did a lot of music stuff last week. Tonight I think I need to do, you know, sort of a recap of everything that went on for the last the last 7 days. But this will air probably tomorrow night. So then it'll go up then. So about Air America, I know like Ron Reagan is not doing anything. He may be shopping around, trying to find a syndicator or something. But, you know, what I decided to do was just take it online immediately. I mean, I did my show the night that, the announcement came down. I just moved it online. And what I'm going to start doing, I think, is putting together, self-contained hours of programming from the shows on the weeknight and offer them to stations for weekends because they all need weekend programming.
I think that's a great idea.
Right. And then promote my weeknight show and and eventually I'll set up my podcast on a subscription basis and hopefully I can eke out a living like that.
No, I think that's a really good idea, and also especially if you can get the word out through the social networking stuff, and it's radio seems to be adapting to the online world, now maybe a few years ago not so much, but in the last few years radio has started to adapt to the online world in a good way, and I think that's a good plan.
Yeah, and we're getting there, and within cars already have. A lot of them already have Wi-Fi capability, and I know like Chrysler even announced in some of their 2010s they're going to have an in-dash Wi-Fi, a component. So it's coming.
How cool is that?
It's very cool. So yeah,
that's what I really need. Is I need an option to be able to check my email and browse the internet while I'm driving.
Well, I'm more talking about internet radio. So
yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
All right. Joe Hill is with us, and Joe's brand new book is out. It's called Horns. And, Joe, I got to admit that I never read Heart-Shaped Box, but the more I read about you, the more interested I am in reading your books. And because of all the great critical acclaim, I mean, you can't pay for praise like you've gotten for your Heart-Shaped Box and 20th Century Ghosts and now the new book, Horns. And you came on the phone this morning, well, it's afternoon now, with such great energy. And I know you've been doing these interviews for a while. I would expect from someone who writes horror, thriller, macabre kind of stuff, I expected a totally different energy from you.
Yeah, to be gloomy, be dark,
yeah.
But, the thing about writing horror or dark fiction, is that, I sort of squeeze all that darkness out onto the page, and then I get to go out and be my sunny self, be sort of an ordinary guy. It's the thing that I love best about writing. I spend 6 hours a day in a room by myself listening to the voices in my head.
Wow.
And I can tell people that, and they smile and they think, oh, how charming, how creative, but if your investment banker told you that he spent 6 hours a day in a room by himself listening to the voices in his head muttering to himself, you'd probably look for someone else to invest with.
Yeah, that would not be good. But so you chose the right field to go into.
I think so.
Now, I was reading on your blog at joehillfiction.com. You've just started the book tour for Horns, and you're up in New England, which is where you grew up.
It's my home turf. That's right.
Uh-huh. I want to get this out of the way now because did you always know you were going to be a writer?
I did, both. I think I know what you're leading to. Both my parents write. My dad is Steve King. My mom is the novelist Tabitha King. She's written 7 great books, and And, you know, I remember coming home from school when I was 12 years old, and my mom would be shut away into her office, and she'd be clattering away at the keys. And my dad would be up in his office, and he'd be banging away at the keys. And just at a very early age, it seemed like the most natural thing in the world to me, you know, to go and sit by yourself, be by yourself in a quiet room for a couple hours and play make-believe, and eventually someone would pay you for it.
Yeah.
So, I come from a very loving and supportive family, and I think when that's the kind of environment you grow up into, it's natural to be interested in the work that your parents do. And, you know, our conversation around the dinner table was always literary conversation, and it was just natural to want to do something in books.
So, but did you always have the horror gene? I mean, is that something that do you sit around and tell scary stories, or is this part of your family talk?
Well, there's a couple things to say there. One is that, you know, when I started trying to write professionally, there were two things that I did. The first is that I dropped my last name. And I decided to write as Joe Hill instead of as Joseph King. And I did that because I had a fear that if I would write something, there would be a risk that I might write something mediocre and that a publisher might publish it anyway because he'd see a chance to make a quick buck on the last name. And, you know, readers might buy your first book because you have a famous last name, but if the book's no good, they won't buy your second. So that was one of the choices I made, was I decided to write under the pen name. Another choice I made was initially, you know, I had gone to a good college, went to Vassar College, and I did the writing workshops and everything, and I felt like I would try to make it with mainstream fiction. And I never quite found the knack of that. My mainstream stories, I think, were well written in some ways, but they were kind of dead at the center. You know, I would write these stories about divorce or about children trying to understand their complicated parents. And those stories never really came to life for me. The first stories that I wrote that seemed to excite other people and that I felt excited about myself always had a core of suspense to them. And as I've gotten older, I've become more of a coward, and I've come to feel that out of cowardice, I depend on that engine of suspense, because I'm afraid people will put my book down and find something to look at on YouTube instead, you know. And I think if you can crank up the suspense enough, you know, they'll keep turning the pages, and that's what you hope for, that you'll give them a reason to stay glued to the book.
Right. You know, I hadn't even thought of that. There's a lot more competition for people's time now than there was, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I want people to invest. You know, a book can take anywhere from 10 to 15 hours to read. That's a big investment of people's time. And, you know, I always want to make it worth it. I want it to be a fun ride and, you know, to really mash the gas pedal down and keep things moving and keep it exciting. And hopefully, you know, the reader will walk away feeling like they had a good time. So, you know, so it was natural for me to, it was natural for me to eventually wind up writing horror, because I think that if suspense is the element that keeps people turning the pages, you know, then if you push suspense to its edge, you wind up naturally in the territory of horror fiction.
All right, I see. Well, Joe Hill is with us. You know, I'm looking at your picture on the back cover of the book Horns, and you look really, really young. Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 37.
Okay.
But you know, but it's clean living. Yeah.
You got that boyish face. So tell us about Horns. Yeah. What? Give us the thumbnail of the book.
Okay. Well, Horns is the story of a good guy, a decent guy named Ig Parrish, and you know, Ig is a follow the rules kind of guy, and his whole life is turned upside down when his childhood sweetheart Marin Williams is murdered. And in the small town of Gideon, New Hampshire, most people believe that Ig is actually the person who killed her, even though he's never officially charged with the crime. So Ig grieves for about a year, and then one night he goes out on a drunken bender, and he raves and curses God. And when he wakes up the next morning, he discovers he's grown a pair of horns. Mm. And you know, he immediately goes to the doctor, which is what I'd do if I grew a pair of horns. And, you know, he doesn't get any help there. He goes to see a priest and doesn't get any help from the priest. He goes to see his parents. No one really wants to help him. All they want to do is make these terrible confessions They want to tell them about their ugliest secrets and their dirtiest impulses. And Ig comes to realize that he's inherited the powers of the devil. And it isn't long before he decides to turn those powers to find the person who destroyed his life and killed Marin.
Wow. All right. It sounds fascinating.
You know, I think it's sort of there are a tradition of stories about the devil in American literature, and they're almost always revenge stories. They're almost always stories about people getting, you know, about the wicked getting their just desserts. I come from a part of New England where, you know, a couple centuries ago we drowned witches.
Right.
You know, and there's this, you know, fascination with sort of morbid supernatural stories of crime and punishment. And so this kind of falls in that tradition.
You know, you mentioned, all right, that your dad is Stephen King. I know he's got a great love of great rock and roll music. I know his tastes are pretty closely aligned with mine. I would guess you grew up with some of that as well?
Yeah, very much. I mean, so much so that my first novel, Heart-Shaped Box, the protagonist was actually a burned-out heavy metal musician in his 50s,
uh-huh.
a guy named Judas Coyne. And in that story, you know, my hero, Jude, he collects oddities. He has, you know, grotesque oddities. He has a witch's confession. He has cartoons drawn by John Wayne Gacy. And he hears about a woman selling a haunted suit online. And he thinks, this would be perfect for my collection. So he buys it. And it turns out that there really is a ghost attached to it, a very bad ghost.
Wow.
And the book, you know, explores what happens to him once this comes into his life. But, and Horns also has, you know, a kind of recurring, it turns back to pop music and rock music over and over again. You know, when I wrote the book, I thought for a long time about what kind of devil I wanted to look at. And I decided I really didn't want it to be a 370-page theological argument.
Uh-huh.
And the devil I wanted to write about is the devil we see in blues and pop music and rock and roll. And in rock and roll, you know, the devil is usually a symbol for every temptation that you really ought to hurry up and give into. And that was the devil I wanted to write about in Horns, the devil of rock and roll.
Very cool. I had a feeling that would be part of your repertoire there. Joe Hill is with us. The new book is Horns, and I'm really looking forward to reading this. Now, when we first started talking, the first question you asked me was about, you know, what happened with Air America and the other hosts. I also know that your father has dabbled in radio stations and just flipped a station up in Maine to a progressive talk format. And I please thank him for me, because we don't have enough progressive voices out there. And the majority of radio stations in the country are owned by huge corporations, and the big corporations tend to favor the Republicans because the Republicans favor them. So it's great that he took a station and is putting some good progressive talk on there.
I just think it's important for there to be a national conversation, and you don't have that if there's only one voice doing all the talking. So yeah, anytime you have a diversity of voices, it's great. And Maine, you know, where I grew up, it's a state filled with practical problem solvers. I mean, you know, that sounds kind of corny, but it's true. It's, you know, it's in some ways it's a very apolitical state. Or maybe I should say the only politics they care about are the politics of getting things done. And I guess you would have to say that based on the way things have gone in the last few months, it can't be sitting too well back at home. Anyway, sort of right now we're in a political moment where nothing is getting done.
But I got to commend the two senators from Maine are two of only five, and the fact that there are five, I shouldn't say only, two of five Republicans who actually voted to end the filibuster on the jobs bill. So, and that's a huge step.
It's funny because, you know, there really is, there really are several Republican parties. I mean, the very first person I voted for, I voted Republican the first time I could cast a vote, and the person I voted for was Bill Cohen. But I don't think that the modern Republican Party, I don't think, would mostly recognize Bill Cohen as one of their own, because he was so, you know, he was so sort of not an ideological person. You know, he was more of a practical kind of problem-solving person. And, you know, it is a shame, I think, that, you know, so much of the national conversation has been skewed towards, you know, the fight instead of, you know, the battle instead of the solution. You know, and, well, you know, pick your issue. Whatever it is, it can be turned into, you know, an ideological screeching match instead of, you know, a place where people can hopefully work something out that's good for everyone.
Yeah, you got that right. And hopefully, you know, this vote, I think it was yesterday that this happened, is just the beginning. And maybe, you know, I had been screaming at Obama for this, you know, get over the quest for bipartisanship already, because it's never going to happen. But maybe the repetition of it is shaming some of them into saying, okay, we got to start working with you.
Maybe. You don't know what's going to happen.
No.
You know, I mean, I sometimes think there's plenty of blame to go around.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that it's, you know, I think that one thing which doesn't make sense is, you know, if there's going to be a continuous threat of the filibuster, then probably that, you know, that threat should be forced at some point.
I agree.
That, you know, if every single issue is going to be shot down just by the threat of the filibuster, sooner or later you would think that the Democrats would say, okay, well, now we're actually going to have to have the filibuster. And you know, and so they're not really doing their job when they just allow the threat alone to end any conversation.
I agree.
I don't know. It's not a – there have been other moments that have been kind of sorry on the national scene, but this is definitely right up there.
I couldn't agree with you more. Joe Hill, I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and I know I'm going to really enjoy your books. The new one is Horns, Joe Hill, and the website
– thanks so much.
JoeHillFiction.com, and thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you today. All right, so there you have Joe Hill, yes, the son of Stephen King. Okay, it is that time.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Time to find out what happened today in Washington, D.C., and for that we turn to the Talk Radio News Service at talkradionews.com, and who's on the line?
Tala from Talk Radio News. How are you, Nicole?
Good. How are you doing, Tala?
Okay. I mean, there's a lot going on, as we know, as you were just discussing. A positive thing that happened today was that the Senate approved the job bill, which was for $15 billion. It was downsized phenomenally by Harry Reid, who had to make some concessions to get everybody on board. But it's not a bad achievement. It's giving those smaller businesses some incentives. They get some Social Security breaks through December. They get a $1,000 credit if they hire somebody who's unemployed, a new worker. So there are some incentives for those small businesses, as Obama had indicated. Also, they're pumping in about $20 billion to develop highways and mass transit systems ahead of this kind of spring construction season. So this is a good news for other construction workers and people who want to get into those projects as well.
Cool. There was also some legislation that passed the House overwhelmingly that was doing away with the antitrust exemption for the for-profit health insurance industry.
That's right. It's interesting what's going to happen, especially with the health summit taking over Washington tomorrow, in terms of what Obama's going to be able to push forward if this health care bill doesn't, in fact, pass at some point. How much will insurance companies be allowed to get away with in terms of profitability and their finances?
Right. Now, so about this vote, the vote was 406-19 in the House to repeal the antitrust exemption for health insurance companies. And so now it moves to the Senate. And is there any indication on what the Senate is going to do? I mean, it was pulled out of the Senate plan to appease Ben Nelson, of course, the conservative senator from Nebraska.
No idea what's going to happen with it.
Okay.
I mean, you're right. It was pulled out. I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see.
All right. Yes, it certainly will be. But, you know, it's interesting.
We know clearly that they don't necessarily agree. So but, we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. The fact that this passed the House 406-19, by the way, all 19 who voted against the repeal are Republicans. How anyone could vote to keep the insurance industry to have an antitrust exemption basically allows them to collude and set prices and, you know, take advantage of us. I need to get a list of the vote and see who voted.
Well, that's exactly it, Nicole. We need control over these insurance companies being able to make vast profits at the expense of a sick person who needs cheap and affordable health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And what Obama is going to try to do is say, look, you know, I was doing a lot of interviews today on the radio and people are asking me, well, Americans just don't trust the guy. They don't, his trust isn't there.
They don't trust who? Obama?
Well, they don't trust what he has to say in terms of he's looking out for their best, you know, he's looking out for them in terms of health care. And I think that you have two different sides of opinion in terms of where you want to go with what he's doing. But from my perspective, he's going to try to get this through and primarily to do it so that these health insurance companies can't make the judgments anymore, that it's going to give the power to the patient to be able to say, look, you know, it's got to be affordable. It's got to be without preconditions. And it's going to be a tough battle, but tomorrow's summit I don't think is going to be the end all. There's a lot of talk today about holding a kind of Camp David-like private closed-door summit. And a lot of members of GOP have been calling for something where they could start from scratch at this closed-door summit. It wouldn't be televised.
But they want everything, you know, that the Republicans want everything out in the open. They want full transparency, unless it's a time that is, it's going to show them up for the sort of know-nothing obstructionists that they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's Bart Stupak was saying today that he's got a tough battle dealing with the Democrats as well in the House. You know, if Obama's going to try to push this bill through, you know, kind of the budget reconciliation process, which is clearly he's indicating he's going to do when he released that proposal earlier this week, then the abortion issue is out. And people who are in the House who are Democrats find that unacceptable, he said today. He doesn't want public funding of abortion, and that's very clear. And they're going to try to scuttle the bill.
Well, of course, they've been trying to scuttle it. They've been trying to scuttle it from day one. All right. So what else went on today? Anything else of import that we need to know about, or is all the hype building up to tomorrow?
All the hype is building up until tomorrow. But it was interesting. Hillary Clinton was speaking today as well before Finance Committee, and she was saying that all of this back and forth. Fighting and bickering, bipartisan bickering, is spreading globally and manifesting. And on her travels, people are saying, what's going on over there? So this is an interesting viewpoint that it's not just a national thing with our town halls. It's like a lot of people are in this around the globe as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they are. It's sort of we're all in this together. The difference is how different countries fix it. You know, and some countries are faring better than others. So,
yeah, I mean, and, you know, Toyota was there today. I'm sure you heard about, your audience knows, and you know the hearings that took place with Toyota, and you know, their market is finished in Asia and Europe. And they're just trying to keep the brand up in America. But, you know, you have the head of Toyota apologizing.
Yeah,
for
well,
brake failures.
You know, this is another topic that I really haven't talked about. Again, if I was out... all last week when the story broke about the Toyota problems. But I did watch some of the hearings today. I saw Dennis Kucinich questioning his name escapes me now, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, I believe it was. And, you know, boy, Toyota, that was the company, the car company that you thought, you know, you asked what's the best made car out there. And the answer was usually Toyota, most reliable. And this is just everything's turned upside down in the automotive industry right now, huh?
And, you know, and he had apologized today. He had accepted his responsibility. You know, you had 34 deaths, the highest number since the Pinto, the Ford Pinto in the 1970s.
Yeah, I remember the Pinto thing where the gas tanks were exploding. Well, the most,
right.
And there's one piece of footage that's been repeated quite a bit throughout the day. Ray LaHood, thank you. That's who it was. The Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood. Thank you to Paul in the chat room for telling me. Yeah, of this woman, the blonde woman who was in the car and her car started accelerating up to 100 miles per hour and she had both feet on the brakes. She pulled the safety, you know, she pulled the parking brake and it wasn't slowing down. And she called her husband because she thought this was it and she was dead. And she broke down crying. And I don't know how she finally stopped the car, but I can't even imagine the terror in that when you're, you know, if something like that were to happen.
Well, there are 2.3 million vehicles of that kind out there. That's what's scary.
Yeah.
And 34 of them, well, we know 34 and this woman and other few other cases, but where are the other millions?
Well, maybe they haven't had the problems yet. I mean, they don't show up on every car. But the scariest part of it was when Toyota said that, look, even when you get them, your car's fixed, you bring it in for the recall and we fix it, that's not a guarantee that the problems are solved. So, because
right. you could always have a problem in the future, and you could just be on a wet highway, and
right.
all of a sudden your brakes go out.
Now they're saying it's probably an electrical problem. And if, as you know, if you've ever had a car with an electrical problem and you take it in, they, you know, half the time they don't know what the hell is up. I have a problem. I've got I have a Mazda actually, and I've had a problem where the gear shift won't come out of park. And for some reason, when my car does that, it affects the brake lights, too. So when that happens, and I found the way, there's a trick. If you ever can't get your car out of gear, there's a little trick. Now I know how to find it to get it out of gear. But you're riding around without brake lights. And it's an electrical problem. And it took them at least 5 times of me having the car in there before they finally fixed it.
You know, you and I sound like the female version of Car Talk. On our own show.
Yeah, although, you know, I sound like the callers to Car Talk. You know, the thing in it makes a sound like a broom, broom. That's how you get on Car Talk. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. So we'll be calling in to speak with you about it and give you the wrap-up.
Terrific. Great. All right. Tala Dolachowski from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks a lot, Tala. We'll talk soon. All right. Before we move on, a couple of things I want to share with you before we get Thomas Frank on the phone. I found this story while I was gone, while I was on vacation, and it blew my mind, and I was surprised I didn't see it really take on a life of its own. And Andrew Sullivan, who writes the Daily Dish, you know, from the Atlantic. In fact, I've got him on my blog roll. I don't agree with everything he writes, but I love his stuff. I mean, I love the fact that he says what he thinks and feels. And, you know, again, I enjoy some writers that I disagree with because when they come from a place of intelligence, right? So saying that, this was a piece he wrote on I can't find the date here, but it was almost at the beginning of the month. I didn't come across it until last week when I was out in California. And sorry, but we're going to talk Sarah Palin again for a minute here, okay? You know, all her kids have sort of odd names, but I believe they all come from somewhere, like Bristol. You know how Bristol got her name? Bristol is named after the town, I believe it's Bristol, Connecticut, where ESPN is based. And Sarah Palin, you know, she studied journalism in school, and she was a TV sportscaster. And she, her goal apparently was to work at ESPN. So she named her firstborn Bristol. Okay. Well, now her youngest child is named Trigg. And we know that Trigg has Down syndrome. Well, the medical term for Down syndrome is trisomy 21 or trisomy G. And it is often shortened in medical slang to tri-G. Yes, Trigg. Trigg. Tri-G is the medical slang for Down syndrome. And so here's just a little paragraph from Andrew Sullivan's piece about this at The Atlantic. And again, I will post the entire link. I'll post the link to the entire column on my blog tonight at radioornot.com. It is not perfectly possible that the very name given to this poor child being reared by Bristol is another form of mockery of his condition, along with the retarded baby tag. And does the way in which this poor child was hauled around the country on a book tour, being dragged out in front of flash photographs in the middle of the night, barely clothed, suggest someone who actually cares for children with special needs, or rather sees them as a way to keep the spotlight on her? Her kid's name, her Down syndrome child, his name is Trigg, which is, again, I gotta say this. I can't say it enough. The medical term for Down syndrome is trisomy-G, T-R-I-S-O-M-Y-G. It is often shortened in medical slang to tri-G. His name is Trigg, T-R-I-G. I am stunned. Now, although the mainstream media does pick up on some of the Sarah Palin idiocy, why this didn't get more play, I don't know. What, and again, as Andrew Sullivan pointed out, what are the chances that she just pulled out of thin air the name Trigg? Come on, you're right. See, Paul 58 in the Ustream chat room said that cannot be coincidental. That's what I think, too. Again, I will post, let me see if I can pull up this entire column, because Andrew Sullivan is just so brilliant. Maybe I can read the, you know, more of it for you, because it's not a very long piece. Here it goes. It's from his Daily Dish column, and it's from February 3rd. It's called Palin, Emanuel, Pot, Kettle. And of course, and I'll read it for you. Did she really just call for Rahm Emanuel to be fired because he allegedly used the term effing retarded to refer to fellow Democrats in a private meeting last summer? Did she really? I don't like the term myself. I think it's offensive. I think Rahm Emanuel is offensive. But at least he's real, and he has now apologized. At least he used the term metaphorically. Again, I'm reading from Andrew Sullivan's blog. Palin, in contrast, called her own campaign prop her retarded baby in private, according to an eyewitness account from the father of her own grandson who lived in her house for months and knew her intimately. Quote, I was just in shock the first time I heard it, Levi Johnston told CBS. Unlike Sarah Palin, Johnston has not been caught in multiple indisputable lies. I believe him over her. In fact, in any factual dispute, I believe anyone over her. See, I just so agree with Andrew Sullivan here. All right, back to it. While I'm at it, does anyone actually believe that Palin's name for the child of miraculous provenance was found by her deep knowledge of ancient Norse, as she claims in her magical realism novel, Going Rogue? I mean, seriously, she knows about as much ancient Norse as she does English grammar. It's as credible as the idea that she gave a speech while having contractions several hours after going to labor, as she claims in her novel. It's as credible as her amazing journey in labor with a special needs child on a plane flight where flight attendants, according to the Anchorage Daily News, did not even notice she was pregnant. It's as credible as any number of indisputable, self-serving, unbalanced lies that she has told in the public record for years. The medical term for Down syndrome is trisomy 21 or trisomy-G. It is often shortened in medical slang to tri-G, Trigg. It is not perfectly possible that the very name given to this poor child being reared by Bristol is another form of mockery of his condition, along with a retarded baby tag. And does the way in which this poor child was hauled around the country on a book tour, being dragged out in front of flash photographs in the middle of the night, barely clothed, suggest someone who actually cares for children with special needs, or rather sees them as a way to keep the spotlight on her? Come on, Levi, write that book. Expose this fraud. Again, I will link to this article from RadioOrNot.com tonight. I am still just blown away. And I'll tell you what. Jules, I see in the chat room, is having trouble getting the stream to play. Jules, if you know what? I'm going to let me play a song here. You know what? Yeah, I'll play a song here. And I will help you all figure out another way to if you're having trouble. No one else is having buffering trouble. I wonder if it's Jules' internet that's down. But let me play you a song, yet another one of the bands I saw performing at Sunset Sessions this weekend that blew me away. In fact, there's a picture. If you go to RadioOrNot.com and the blog I posted last night, I put some pictures up from Sunset Sessions. There's one picture with my boyfriend and me and this guy. It's John Butler. It's actually the John Butler Trio. Here at Radio or Not, and in a moment, back with Thomas Frank. Don't go away.
Fire, fire. Bottom fire, fire. I want to thank you for the seeds you planted in me. And I want to thank you for the earth that boosts my feet. I want to thank you for the sun that my leaves, and I say,
thank you, sunshine.
I want to thank you for the mystery.
Ah, it's the John Butler Trio. Feeling Free is the name of that song. And yes, John Butler was one of the many bands who played at the event I was at in San Diego last week, Sunset Sessions. And if you go to my website, radioornot.com, I did post some pictures last night from Sunset Sessions, a couple with Melissa Etheridge, and definitely one with John Butler of the John Butler Trio. And yes, Paul 58 in the chat room, he is from Australia. Really, really nice guy, and they were so, so good. All right, let's get Thomas Frank on the line now from the Wall Street Journal, who again has just an amazing piece up today, and here it is, called "What's the Matter with Democrats?"
Hello,
Thomas.
Hello.
Frank.
Hi,
it's Nicole Sandler with Radio or Not.
And how are you today?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm good. Do you want to call me on the landline?
You know what?
Fine?
This is fine, and we are on the air or internet. We are live, I guess I should say. So this sounds
so
fine.
That right now, people are listening to us?
Right now, people are listening to us.
And
a lot of your fans are here. I got to say, when I said Thomas Frank is coming on, that, you know, I just played a song because one of my favorite listeners. I've got two chat rooms going, so I get instant feedback from listeners while we're doing the show. And one listener, Jules, who's with me a lot, she couldn't get the stream for some reason. Her connection died, and so I played a song to give her time to get reconnected. So Jules is back because she definitely wanted to hear you. Great. So I was just telling them, the first part is you wrote a great column today at the Wall Street Journal. What's the matter with Democrats? And, you know, that's all you need right there. And the subtitle is "The Party Embraced Globalization While Its Union Allies Were Cut Down." But all we need is that first part of the headline, and you can insert your own joke right there. What's the matter with Democrats? We could talk for an hour about that alone.
Well, it's frustrating. I mean, just to begin with, I mean, you're looking at, you know, this sort of grassroots conservative uprising saying all the same things that conservatives have been saying for the last 40 years, you know, ever since the mid-1960s, and every time the Democrats are blindsided by it. It's always this shocking surprise to them that this happens. You know, they can't figure it out, and it's like, come on, guys, how many times has this happened to you, you know?
Well, you know, even back in 2008, when it looked like the Democrats couldn't lose the election, the joke was, you know, they're so great at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. The Democrats seem to constantly shoot themselves in the foot. They're masters at the circular firing squad. I mean, every stupid cliche about, you know, taking a sure thing and blowing it just applies to the Democrats. And it seems like, you know, it's happening right now, too. They, you know, the whole hope and change and everything. And here we are a year later. And people like me who are diehard liberals saying, what's going on? There's no difference between these two parties.
Yeah, they really let the victory, you know, slip through their fingers. And it's been a really depressing thing for me to watch. Let's take a step back, Nicole. I mean, all my life I've been, well, most of my adult life anyway, I've been, you know, pretty liberal, and I've always focused on the economic issues. And people used to always say, you know, when will the public come around to realizing how much they need, you know, these various, you know, government intervention in the economy, blah, 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 blah. Will it take another Great Depression for them to understand that? Well, we've got it. You know, we've got the worst economy in many, many, many decades. You know, the Democrats came in 2008. They can't do a damn thing. And all of a sudden, you've got people who are hard hit by the recession moving way to the right. This is not how it's supposed to work. You know, look, what got me started on this was there's a good article in the New York Times about Tea Party rank and file. Grassroots Tea Party movement people, and they've moved to this sort of extreme, like Bircher style right wing position after being victims of the recession. In the story, we talk about how these people had lost their jobs, or some member of their family had been foreclosed upon.
or some other terrible thing had happened to them in the course of the recession, and this brought them over to this like extreme right-wing position where they want to, you know, destroy government and deregulate more and cut taxes and all this sort of insane stuff that won't help matters any. But what keeps going through my mind when I read this is, whatever happened to the party of Franklin Roosevelt? Why aren't they out there, you know, speaking to these voters? What on earth happened?
Good question. But what happened is, and my thought is, so Obama got in, and we were expecting another New Deal, just what we needed to pull us out of this morass that the 8 years of a Bush administration got us into. But instead of another Franklin Roosevelt and a New Deal, what we got is sort of a, you know, Bill Clinton, middle of the roader guy trying to have everybody like him.
That's right. Well, you got all the Clinton retreads back in the cabinet running.
That's right.
I mean, so look, some of Obama's people, just so your listeners know, I'm a big fan. I voted for him. I'm a big fan of a lot of his cabinet choices are really, really good. I like him a lot. But his economic team, you know, retreads from the Clinton years, same old story. And the really awful thing is I think the public would forgive him, you know, the fact that he hasn't been able to get his program passed, if he would just give them an explanation, if he would just get out there and get his hands dirty and talk about the troubles that people are having and who caused them and why. You know, talk about how 8 years of extreme, you know, misgovernance allowed this to take place. Talk about how the free market faith, you know, blinded us to it. I mean, even Alan Greenspan has been real forthcoming about that, you know, by comparison.
Right.
But Obama won't even do that because, of course, that's too partisan, you know. And he wants to be Mr. Bipartisan. He wants everyone to – he doesn't want to ruffle feathers. He thinks we should all be in this together. He doesn't give it. These people play for keeps.
So in 2010, is it possible to be bipartisan? And do you think his efforts, his continual calling for bipartisanship is real, or is he trying to make a point?
If he's trying to make a point, he's not making it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even if he is making it, it's not helping him. You know, it's a disaster is what it is. I would say, well, hopefully this will discredit bipartisanship for all time to come. But, you know, that sort of rosy dream of trans partisanship that he had, it was nice rhetoric, but this has been a colossal failure. And there's never been a time when you need, you know, to more, you know, clearly spell out where we went wrong. And yes, that means indicting a whole political philosophy. Well, hell, that political philosophy indicted itself. It lies in ruins around us. I mean, I went to the University of Chicago. That economics department there, you know, that dreamed all this stuff up back in the day, those guys are ashamed of themselves now. I mean, their philosophy is in ruins. But for whatever reason, in politics, it's still, you know, it's still going strong. Obama has to get up there and he has to, you know, tell us what went wrong and exactly why, and in no uncertain terms. I think the public would forgive him the healthcare disaster if he was just willing to do that. But, I mean, well, then the healthcare disaster, that's another story.
Yes, it is.
On and on.
Well, Thomas Frank is with us from the Wall Street Journal. His piece today is What's the Matter with Democrats? And so I'm reading through it, and you talk about that, you know, the party of Franklin Roosevelt can't get out in front of the resulting anger, and working class Massachusetts and even Appalachia now turning away from him. And you say the answer to the riddle is as plain as the caviar on a lobbyist spoon. I love that line.
Know where it comes from?
Yeah.
When I was writing my last book, it was called The Wrecking Crew.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing about lobbyists in D.C., and I was writing about the career of Duke Cunningham. Do you remember this guy?
Oh, of course I do. San Diego, and right?
In one of the guilty pleas around – no, it wasn't a guilty plea. I'm sorry. It was a indictment of the lobbyist that was accused of corrupting Duke Cunningham. It listed all the restaurants that he took Duke Cunningham to. And so I started going around to these restaurants in D.C., and one of them really jumped out at me. I was like, what's up with this place? It just looks like an ordinary restaurant. And then I went there, and they had this caviar, this like total top-of-the-line caviar. And I just had this image of lobbyists feeding it to Duke Cunningham, you know, one at a time.
Unbelievable. But basically, I think the point that you're making is there is not much of a difference now between the big money Republicans and the big money Democrats. And it's either party, it's all about, you know, how much money is being contributed to their campaign coffers rather than, you know, what they're going to do for the American people.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. We all know that. And I mean, everybody knows it, and nobody can figure out a way out of it. That's not going to get struck down by the Supreme Court. But, I mean, look, the ugly secret of American politics is you can't run for office, Nicole, unless you've got loads and loads of money, and you can't get that money unless the business community likes you. And the business community doesn't like people like Franklin Roosevelt, doesn't like Harry Truman, doesn't like John F. Kennedy, you know. They like you know, the Bill Clinton-style Democrats, they like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they like Democrats that are going to deregulate and allow monopolies and, you know, do all those things that you know, centrist-style Democrats do, the Bob Rubin school of Democrats.
Right.
But no, they do not like the other kind. And the problem is, this is a moment when you need the other kind. I mean, if we ever needed them, we need them now.
Right. So is this why middle America is and many Democrats and certainly the independents? You started out the interview by saying, you know, the people who are hurt most by this recession or depression, which many of us believe it is, are turning hard right. I mean, that seems to go against all common logic. So is it because this Tea Party?
You know, Nicole, the right has always had these kind of. This is what my book, What's the Matter with Kansas, was about, is they mm-hmm. have this these sort of ideas that sound like they're very similar to the left. They give you dissent, they give you anger, they shake their fist at the high and the mighty. They sound like a dissenting political party from the, like, they sound like the populists, you know, my first political love, the populist party from the 1890s. Today's Republicans sound a lot like that, you know, railing against elites and elitism and the high and the mighty. They sound radical. They sound like Andrew Jackson. Of course, what they deliver is, you know, laissez-faire. They deliver, you know, Herbert Hoover. You know, they
right.
talk Andrew Jackson and deliver, you know, Richard Nixon or something like that. But the talk is real good. You know, it sounds great. It sounds like you're part of a movement that is rising up, you know, the common people angry at their overlords, angry at their arrogant masters. It's perfect for this kind of climate. The problem is that at the end of the day, it'll make their situation worse. Now, that's just, there's nothing you can do about it if you're not willing to say that, you know. And if the Democrats aren't willing to go out there and fight fire with fire, they're nothing is going to happen. They're going to lose. In fact, they're going to lose for sure now, I think.
Well, and that's really sad, especially because we know the Republicans, you know, their policies are pretty much the exact opposite of helping out the little guy. I mean, one thing they're so adept at is getting people to vote against their own best interests. I mean, what they want is tax cuts for the very wealthy. Doesn't help the guy down the street who just lost his job and can't get health insurance. So my question is, why do people continually buy that? They know where the last 8 years got them under the Bush administration. That's why the Democrats supposedly control both houses of Congress and the White House, even though they don't govern in that respect. They don't act like they control anything. They're still letting the Republicans frame the debate, frame the discourse, and somehow make the American people think that they're the ones who are looking out for their best interests.
Well, you've laid it out very clearly there, but the mistake was when you said they know that the last 8 years of Republican policies were responsible for this. I don't think people do know that. That hasn't been made clear to a lot of people. People think that for some reason, you know, the community reinvestment. I was listening to the radio. I'm out here in Washington State. I was listening to the radio in my car just the other day. You know, an ordinary talk show host was saying how government caused the financial crisis by forcing banks to lend to poor people. That's completely false.
They never did lend
no
to poor people.
Yeah, that's right. That was, you know, the great. you know, conspiracy of the impoverished, you know,
right.
brought down American capitalism. No, it's preposterous, but people believe that because there's nobody telling them anything different. And you have to remember another thing, that the conservatives have very cleverly washed their hands of George Bush. It's not clever, it's good politics. They said, and they were starting this towards the end of his administration. There was a book that came out, they called him an imposter.
Mm-hmm.
He's not an authentic conservative. You go to CPAC the other day, you had Glenn Beck denouncing the Republican Party. They're not conservative enough. They're all rhinos. They're not true conservatives. They're very good at distancing themselves from that stuff. So the problem, they say, is the problem with Bush is, well, first of all, he continued to spend. You know, he ran big government. And second of all, they just didn't go far enough. And they can retreat down this kind of into this kind of authenticity critique where nobody's ever truly conservative, you know, because they never completely hack the state down to nothing. You know, they never get to the Grover Norquist dream, right, where they can drown Uncle Sam in a bathtub.
Right, but you know what?
They never quite get there.
But he came pretty damn close. I mean, I was just thinking about this
sure
today.
Did.
Is, you know, they drove us into the ground. It seemed like they were really wanting to bankrupt the country. They left Obama with this mess that, as critical as I am and have been of Obama's actions or inaction since he took office, I don't know that anybody could have done a whole lot better, although if he had people like Paul Volcker and maybe Elizabeth Warren in there instead of Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, maybe we would be in better shape. But I digress. The thing is, they did drive us into the ground. They did pretty much drive us into, if not into a depression, then on the verge of it. But you're saying that Obama needs to get up there and really keep on driving home the fact that they did this to us. But the few times he's tried to do that, you know, he's got the Republicans all screaming, you know, enough about Bush. Quit blaming everything on Bush. You know,
yeah.
Now it's time for you to own it. And I think part of the problem is most of the airways are dominated by Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and these so-called conservative talkers. I think they're just wingnut crazies on the right. And we don't have equal airtime, so our message is not getting out there to the multitudes of people who just don't pay attention.
That's what you say about the radio is certainly true. But look, Obama could even the score if he
yeah.
wanted to. I
yeah.
mean,
he's a great,
of the United
great
States.
Communicator, Every, right?
That's right, and he's a brilliant speaker and a brilliant man, and you know he has the smartest. He could have the smartest guys in the country working for him in a moment's notice. He could beat these guys easy if he wanted to. I think he's getting some bad advice. But it's a frustrating situation. You know, of course Republicans are going to complain when you dump the blame for the whole thing on them, but they deserve it. It's not just them. I mean, look, there are some good Republicans out there. Not many, but there's some. What's been discredited is that the whole philosophy of government that sort of began with Reagan and came up right to, you know, through George W. Bush, and I would include a lot of Democrats as a, you know, as taking part in that philosophy of government. But that whole thing should be cast aside. And I don't think Obama is ready to do that. I don't think he's willing to go there yet.
Well, and that is a shame. And, you know, again, this is one of the ongoing problems is that the Republicans seem to control the discourse, and they, and you know, the Democrats need a better copywriter. You know, if it was Republicans
sure.
in charge, the phrase public option would never be part of the lexicon. It would have been, you know, Medicare for all, or, you know, they would have framed it in such language that, you know, that people could glom onto and say, yeah, that's what we want. The public option didn't mean anything. But now we're here.
But people do want the public option.
I know.
That's the really creepy thing. People do want it. You know, it's a good, it's a simple, elegant solution to the problem. It's a beautiful solution. And the fact that it's off the table is stunning to me. I mean, instead you come up with this sort of roundabout, you know, Rube Goldberg solution for the problem that's not going to solve anything. It could break down in any one of, you know, 100 different places. It's not going to work. But the public option, you know, it would have solved the problem. It would have controlled costs too. It was a great idea, and the public likes it. The fact that it's off the table, I think, is testimony to how you know, to the sort of cluelessness of the it's going too far. But you know what I mean. The people that are running the show, they just have no imagination.
Well, and it also goes back to what we were talking about before, which is the big money interests and how much control they have over what happens in this country. You know, I just spoke with a guy who wrote a piece on Huffington Post today referring to two articles in the New York Times in which this deal was supposedly cut with the lobby for the for-profit hospitals in the country that basically the White House said there will be no public option in the final health care legislation. Yet here goes Obama saying, oh, I support it. If this comes to me in the legislation, I'll sign it, but he wouldn't commit on it. Well, apparently, no, he won't sign it. This is the deal he made with the hospitals lobbying group saying that he will not have a public option in there. And why is he doing this? But it's all because of money.
That's a really brutal sellout if that's the case, because he campaigned on the public option.
Know.
You remember?
I do.
I thought that was one of his better ideas. That's a wow. That's quite a betrayal if that's the case.
I will email you.
They deal with Big Pharma.
Yeah, right. And that one got all the publicity. But it's
killing them. Isn't that funny? I mean, it's almost as though the extreme right is attacking them from the left sometimes,
yeah.
You know, blaming them for having these corrupt deals with big money. And it's true. They do have these corrupt deals with big money, and they deserve to be blamed for it.
Yeah, I agree. So
it's always such a joy to talk about this stuff.
I know it's frustrating as hell, and so here we are. And I'll email you that piece with the links to the New York Times articles. I mean, it was first reported back in August, and nobody picked up on that. They picked up on the pharma deal, but not this hospital deal. And if that's the case, as recently as this week, Gibbs is saying the only reason that it wasn't included in this new Obama plan, the 11-page. Summary of what they hope to pass through reconciliation, is because there's not 51 votes in the Senate. Well, the thing is, if Obama would signal his support for it, there easily would be 51 votes in the Senate for the public option, because most people want it.
Yeah, and if he had, well, what's worse is if he had, when this debate started last summer, he was riding high, he had a powerful mandate, he could have had anything he wanted passed immediately. They would have done exactly what, it doesn't matter if they don't believe in it. The president has, in his first year in office has the, I mean, you remember Ronald Reagan was able to get all sorts of things passed because, Congress believed that the public opinion had turned a corner. This was that he had an incredible mandate, and they were all people that didn't believe in supply side economics were willing to give it a try because the new president wanted it. Obama could have had the same deal if he had wanted it. He had Rahm Emanuel there. He could have twisted some arms. It would have been easy. And it's deeply frustrating to me that he didn't do it.
So here we are, Thomas Frank of the Wall Street Journal with us here on Radio or Not. Here we are. We're a year into the presidency. The year when he could have gotten stuff done, he blew it. Now we're coming up on the midterm election year where things are not going in his favor. And we had the Supreme Court rule once again in favor of big business over the American people. Where now we're at the mercy of whatever the big corporations want. Look, if Big Pharma wants to derail any candidate, it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, the Obama got elected by spending about $1 billion on his campaign, which is unheard of before. But Big Pharma has profits in excess of like $85 billion a year. It's nothing to them to buy any election, to derail any candidate. What happens next, Thomas Frank? Do we need a constitutional convention, or where do we go?
Well, I mean, that's real depressing, Nicole, and usually I'm the stinker in the room. I'm the one that's really depressing.
Now it's me.
Yeah, you got me beaten this time.
Sorry.
Because I was just going to dwell on how depressing it is that they, that they've gone. I don't know. We're never going to have another chance in our lifetimes, or another 20 years anyways, to pass some kind of good, national health insurance bill. It's just not going to happen. It took years to get around to this, and they blew it. You know, they had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do all kinds of things, and they blew it. They spent all their political capital on bailing out Wall Street. You know, great move, guys. And they got nowhere with the issues that actually matter to their constituents, and that's depressing. There's one thing they could do that would redeem them, and that is they should make it, Nicole, I've always been, partial to third-party movements, but mm-hmm. third-party movements can't get anywhere in America because they're de facto against the law in most states. The strategies that third parties used to use in the 19th century are all illegal.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Not for any good reason, just because the two parties don't want the competition.
Sure.
Well, the Democrats could do, if they wanted to make my day, if they wanted to make me happy again, they could go state by state and get rid of those laws, and I would go out there and organize a third party, and I think that's the only way to go now.
Oh, my God. But see, they don't want to make you happy. They just want to – they're in a perpetual state.
It's not going to happen.
Right. They're in a perpetual state of campaign fundraising for reelection, and any of the solutions would entail them all voting against the system that they're entrenched in now. And so there's a movement on for campaign finance reform to undo the Supreme Court ruling. But so many of them are.
Well, that would be good.
Yeah.
That would be great.
It would be wonderful. I just don't believe that it can happen.
Yeah. Another thing that would have been good is if they had made it easier to organize a labor union. I mean, and not just because I don't dislike labor unions because they give money to the Democratic Party, but they. Labor unions are, if you talk about the grand sweep of historical change in this country, this country was so liberal back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s that it's hard for us to even imagine today, the kind of things that people said and thought. And that was because, labor unions were a huge part of the working population belonged to them, especially in the North. It was probably, somewhere around 40-50% in the, places like Chicago and New York City, that sort of thing. And that whole culture has been completely destroyed, and that's one of the reasons why it's possible for working class people to say, oh, the answers to my problems lie with Glenn Beck.
Yeah.
It's just nutty. But it's possible because that whole working class infrastructure is gone. The Democrats could have, with the card check, they could have at least taken a step towards bringing that back. It would totally change the sort of political complexion of the country if they did that. But, as with all of the big ideas we've been talking about, they dropped the ball.
On that one, too. And now it's in this year, which is now an election year. Is it going to be possible to get anything substantial done? I know, they're trying to get this health care bill through, but as you and I already discussed, the public option won't be included. It's going to be basically the Senate bill, which provides very minimal protections, but yet mandates us to buy insurance from this government-sanctioned extortionist industry.
Isn't it funny? It's a really short walk from, a great program to a terrible program.
Mm-hmm.
it is terrible. It's depressing.
So all Thomas right, Frank
made me really unhappy
I'm
now.
I'm so sorry. But other than us, buying an island somewhere out in the Caribbean or in the Pacific and starting a new country, is there any way out of this? Is there any way back?
Well, the way out is for the Netroots and the grassroots movement to keep the pressure on. I think they got themselves caught up in the, Obama fever, and they all wanted to be on the side of the president. That's great. And I was on the side of the president, and
me too.
I think he's a great man. But I think that they have to keep organizing and not let up the pressure.
Okay. Well, and then I'm doing the right thing because I on almost every show I have somebody on from one of those progressive Democrats of America, Progressive Change Campaign Coalition, the Blue America PAC. I mean, and that's what we need to do is forget about the Democratic Party because you got too many blue dogs in there and too many people who are only interested in lining their campaign coffers. We need real progressives in office to try to take it back because your other solution, which is the third party, isn't going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. Not unless you have legal changes all over the country.
I got it.
Unfortunately, it's not. So, it's keep organizing at the grassroots level.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, Thomas Frank, I know there's a movie coming out. What's the matter with Kansas? Where is the movie?
It's done. It's good. It's a documentary. The filmmaker. It's a beautiful movie, by the way. It's got a lot of critical appreciation and stuff like that. And It's only playing in a few places now. It's going to open in Kansas City in a couple of weeks and then in Washington, D.C. And I think it's playing in a couple other places as well. I went down to Oklahoma City. We were playing it there. But it's really good, and if you get a chance to see it, you should. Among other things, you know, we always think of Kansas as very bland. You know, Dorothy, it's the gray state that's not Oz. It's not beautiful Technicolor, but it actually, Kansas is a beautiful place, and you'll see that in this movie.
Cool. I've never been there. I'm a coaster. You know, I was New York. I was Boston. I was Florida, California. You know, haven't spent much time in the middle of the country, but all the more reason to read What's the Matter with Kansas and The Wrecking Crew, but see the movie too. So I will keep my eyes out and try to get more information on it and pass it along to the listeners. Thomas Rankin,
right.
It is always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us tonight.
Sure thing, anytime.
All right, really appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye.
How amazing is he? Thomas Frank, first of all, can you imagine being, you know, a liberal, a progressive at the Wall Street Journal? he asks for it. And I hate that we commiserated so much because that was sort of a depressing interview. But that's the kind of conversation I think we need. You know, there are too many hosts on the airwaves, on the progressive side, who give Obama too much leeway. And you know what? At this point, he doesn't deserve it. What he needs is the criticism because he can still pull it out, but he needs to do a lot of work before he gets there, right? All right. So tonight on my blog, I will link to all the articles, all the pieces that we talked about today. The podcast will be up. And the video archive will be up as well. But I as soon as we're off the air, I got to run out with Allison and get her a new pair of shoes. Talk about multitasking. All right, before we go, we got another couple of minutes here. I want to play you two clips. One is from yesterday, and I don't know if you saw this or not. Dylan Ratigan, I have trouble with once in a while because he doesn't know when to stop. But that's also one of the reasons I really like him. And he had Joe Wilson on. You remember Joe Wilson, the "you lie" guy? Well, here's a little bit of the of what Dylan Ratigan got into with Joe Wilson yesterday.
We have the best healthcare system in the world.
That's Joe Wilson speaking, by the way.
We have the best healthcare system in the world. For every disease specific, we have the best healthcare anywhere in the world.
If you're rich, if you're stinking rich, you can get
everybody.
Amazing healthcare.
No.
But the disparity in the quality and availability is stunning. And you and I both know that.
I can get great healthcare because
I've got good money. Honestly, I could probably get a villa with three doctors and palm trees. I don't know about that. But most people can't get that.
I'll take you to the poorest county in South Carolina, Allendale, a very nice hospital. I'll take you to another county which is very depressed.
South Carolina has the 33rd worst health care in America, according to the Commonwealth Fund. America has the most expensive health care in the world and the 37th highest quality. We pay more than any country in the world. We have huge amounts of money going to special interests. Our budget is dominated by the health care.
So, yeah, Dylan Ratigan, the problem is so much of his message gets lost because he shouts people down. You know, that's the beautiful thing about radio is you can usually, you know, mute the person on the phone and get your point out and then bring him back. But I still love that he speaks out and says what he thinks. All right. The other one is John Stewart. Now, I didn't do anything on CPAC. Because I was in music land last week and the timing on that was perfect because I was happy not to pay attention, not to watch it because that stuff just drives me crazy. But that's why we say thank God for Jon Stewart.
All right. If you're like me, you are glued to your TV the last few days watching the inspiring displays.
Not me.
The American spirit, the drama, the celebration, showing the true glory and power of what America can accomplish.
Welcome to the conservative comeback and the beginning of the end of the Pelosi Congress.
Oh, God.
CPAC 2010.
Yeah, mother Real America held their yearly Olympics, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And this year's Festival of Whites brought a record-breaking 10,000 people to D.C. for speeches by the brightest stars of the conservative movement. Or as they refer to it,
The conservative Woodstock.
Woodstock for conservatives.
This is like our Woodstock.
Oh, God.
Except, unlike the left's gathering, our women are beautiful.
Oh, God.
In the left's defense, their women were naked, high, and in constant do-it mode.
I love Jon Stewart. So there's your recap of the CPAC convention, just to get a little bit in there. You know what? I'm going to end the show tonight with something that a listener sent me a few weeks ago, and it's been sitting here on my desktop this entire time, and I haven't had the right moment to play it. But to wrap up tonight's show, I think is perfect. It is John F. Kennedy speaking about what it means to be a liberal. Just bear with me. It runs about a minute. But these are the words we need to keep in mind.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with a taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Yeah. Thank you, President Kennedy, and I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal, too. All right. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow, we'll be back. I will spend most of the day glued to the TV watching the healthcare summit. We'll chat about it tomorrow night. I'm not sure who will join me. I think Jack Rice might be joining me for a little, postmortem on it. Maybe John Fugelsang will be with me. But either way, I hope you will be with me back here tomorrow night, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific at, Radio or Not. All the podcasts and everything will be up tonight. All right. But right now I got to run out and get Allison a new pair of shoes. So, thank you again for listening and sharing it with your friends. I'm Nicole Sandler, Radio or Not. Good night.